This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much again to Pardes for hosting me and for being such a fantastic Beit Midrash. The topic tonight is really about how we build communities out of different kinds of people. And what I want to try to offer to you is a framework that I hope will be helpful, not necessarily for like reaching all the conclusions that we might reach on this topic, but a framework for thinking about it, a discourse that we might share about it, even as we potentially resolve these issues in different ways. And the way I want to do that is by thinking through three terms. Yeah, I guess we can put it anywhere here is good. Great. Okay. Yeah. If you're back there, you'll survive. Maybe I'll even do a sort of like turning around tour of what I draw. But most of what you need is on the sheet. This is an issue we face all the time. I think particularly those of us who hang out in places like this Beit Midrash, but really I think contemporary Jews all the time are facing the question. I think actually contemporary citizens of the world face this in politics. How do you create environments that somehow contain a range of people in meaningful connection while allowing each of those individual people and individual subcommunities to be true versions of themselves? So I want to begin by defining three terms, the three terms that are on the triangle on the sheet in front of you. And I want to emphasize something. Let's get this very clear up front. Everything is open for question and for discussion throughout the rest of our session, except for my definition of these three terms. Okay? That's not because these words don't have other meanings. That's not because your meaning might not be better than mine in terms of what the English word means. It just means for the purpose of the discussion, I'm using these terms in very specific ways. And that's going to guide and anchor the whole analysis of the text and the topic more generally. All right? So let's define them as I'm using them. Pluralism. What do I mean by pluralism for the next hour and 20 minutes? I'm defining it. Pluralism means as follows. By pluralism, I mean that I minimally tolerate and maximally celebrate people interpreting things in different ways and acting on those different interpretations. Minimally I tolerate and maximally I celebrate people actually disagreeing not just in theory, but in practice. Okay? So for instance, in Jewish life, we have pluralism all the time. I might not eat rice on Pesach, someone else might eat rice on Pesach, and neither of us is necessarily trying to change the other to come around to the other practice. We live in a pluralistic environment where we say you can do it that way and you can do it that way. We do that in other areas, let's say, of ritual practice, like Nusach HaTfilah, the ways in which we actually say the actual words that are obligatory. There are people who come from a tradition of Nusach Ashkenaz, people who come from a tradition of Nusach Sfarad, people that come from Nusach Chalab, other places in the Jewish world where there are different words. None of those traditions is really trying to say we are crushing the other tradition. There's a sort of pluralistic manifestation which we even potentially think is a good thing. We minimally tolerate it. We maximally think it's a good thing. We'll come back to this. The place probably where pluralism most robustly manifests itself is in a kind of pure and vital culture of Talmud Torah, where we generally recognize the idea that people disagreeing about things is on some level sort of the lifeblood of what makes rabbinic discourse rabbinic. And certainly lines like Elu va'elu divrei Elokim chayim, these and those are the words of the living God, are manifestations of the pluralistic impulse that I'm trying to capture by this word. This person thinks this way, this person thinks that way. Pluralism says, that's great. That's a robust Beit Midrash. That's value number one. Value number two is what I'm calling integrity here. This is going to be the hardest one for you, I suspect, because everyone wants to feel like they have integrity. But I'm not using integrity in a way that lacking integrity is necessarily bad. But here's the definition. Integrity is being completely consistent about what you understand to be the correct and ideal way to behave. Being completely consistent about your interpretation of a text, of a norm, and how it's supposed to translate. So, for instance, if I want to maximize my integrity as a vegetarian, I will never eat meat. Even when I go to my grandparents' house and they don't really understand it and they just want to serve me the regular food. Even when I go to someone's to a different environment where it's going to potentially make someone uncomfortable. It's going to create a situation where actually some degree of inconsistency would make everyone feel better about the situation. To maximize integrity means not to compromise, whereas when you compromise or you decide, well, it's not so important that I have to be consistent here, you are taking a hit on your integrity as I'm defining it here. All right, so integrity, again, is a kind of consistent approach to your values and your interpretations. In rabbinic literature, this is probably best captured as, "Ein ma'achilin la'adam davar ha'asur lo." You never feed someone else or yourself something that they understand to be forbidden, even if you're aware that there are other interpretations out there in the world. You're aware that there's other good people who eat meat in the world. If you've decided you're a vegetarian, you maximize integrity by never compromising. The third value is community. And this is one we use in all kinds of different ways. Here's what I mean by it for this presentation. Community means that I make myself vulnerable to and dependent on the decisions and practices and statuses of other people. I make myself vulnerable to and dependent on things that other people do. So, for instance, to have community around food, in the sense I'm using it here, means I go into someone else's house and they serve me a meal. I have not installed a supervisor in the kitchen, and I simply eat what they serve me, no questions asked. And the next week, I invite them over and I serve them, and there's no supervisor in my kitchen, and they eat what I serve them, no questions asked. There's a kind of blurring of lines around ourselves, obviously mixed in with trust, where I have attained community with that person over food. If you have an event where you order catered food and eat it next to someone on paper plates, you are not, in the sense I am using the term, having community with them around food. You may be having community with them over discussion while eating. But actually what you're doing by ordering catered food and putting on paper plates is saying, I actually can't and don't want to blur this boundary with you for any number of reasons. We're going to have to find a way other than through blurring our boundaries around food to share space, to share an experience. When you allow yourself to be counted in a minyan for someone else or count them in a minyan, you are having community with them around prayer. They're fulfilling your obligation. You're having community with them around prayer. You are saying, this person is sort of crossing the line into my space and I into theirs. Okay? Those are the three values, pluralism, integrity, and community. The basic thesis of this evening's learning is you cannot have all three of those maximized at the same time. That is simply impossible. You are always trading off. All of us in our complex communal decisions are trading off. Which of these do we prioritize over the other? Some of us may be doing that fairly consistently for reasons maybe we'll get to exploring. Other of us may prioritize one of these in some situations, two of them in others, yet a third one in others. But I would contend to you almost every single discussion and difficult issue we have around constructing communities of difference comes down to basically the choices presented by this triangle. Just to give you one other example of how this plays out and what it means to trade off the different values. Discussions around what to do around davening at the Kotel are a classic manifestation of the dilemma of this triangle, and you can see all the different strategies for resolving it. There are some people whose response is to say, we have to kill pluralism. We have to say, there's one way to daven at the Kotel, and everyone's going to do it with utmost consistency, and as a result, everyone will be able to be one Jewish people at the Kotel. One side's going to have to lose. For some people, that manifests as saying there's not going to be any egalitarian davening at the Kotel. For other people, that manifests as saying we're going to, you know, actually sometimes simply have, like, on Monday it's going to be this way, and that way it's going to be that way. There's going to be some sort of, like, fixed thing. Everyone's going to have to deal with it. No one's going to be protected from it. One system. Other people say, no, integrity is going to have to suffer, which is to say different Jews daven different ways. They all need to share the same kotel. You're going to have to show up and encounter things that you don't particularly like from time to time that are going to be inconsistent. So someone who wishes it wasn't happening is going to confront, sometimes on Rosh Chodesh, on other times, women showing up and wearing tefillin. People who think it's an abomination that there's any kind of gender discrimination at the Kotel are going to have to show up and encounter that at least some of the time, not all the time, all day. But that you're going to sacrifice the integrity piece. And then, yet others, advocate sacrificing community. There's no way we can have all these people in the same place. And we can't ask people to be, you know, compromise on their individual commitments. And Jews don't all daven the same way. So this part of the wall is going to have this rule, and that part of the wall is going to have that rule. And we're just going to agree to go our separate ways. All right? And all the discussions about that and all the tensions back and forth are just playing out the advantages and disadvantages of those different options. Okay, so now what I want to do is go into an example which will ground this not just in my mind and this triangle, but in a set of rabbinic texts. And I want to see us kind of struggle, I want us to watch these texts struggle through this question. All right, so now I'm going to take you into a slightly obscure but hopefully bearable example from the laws of Yivamot, from the laws of levirate marriage laid out in the Torah, which is going to set up the case that we need to understand our discussion. Anyone feel like they can give me a brief, on one foot summary of what is levirate marriage? What does the Torah have to say about it? What are we talking about when we use that term? Anyone feel like they've got that? Yeah, please.
If a man dies without having a child, and he has, so his widow has to marry his brother or other close relative in order to perpetuate his name in his name.
Okay, good. A man dies childless, and he is married to a woman. I'm just drawing the schematic up here of the family, which is two brothers side by side, and the wife. I won't try to turn it around, but if you want, you can like pop up at some point and just take a peek, and then you get the whole picture. All right? The brother in the middle here dies. Okay? And assuming that this surviving brother was childless, there is then... the dead brother. Assuming the dead brother was childless, there is a bond that is formed between these two, okay, between this man and his sister-in-law. And the Torah says that they should get married, as you say, and then they should have a child, and that child should be named after the dead brother. Essentially, his patrilineal patriarchal line is resurrected from the dead, okay? That's the normal case that's supposed to happen, and to the extent they don't want to, they do not want to consummate that marriage and affirm that bond has to be severed. That is to say, this woman can't just pick up and leave and go marry whoever she wants. They'll have to do the action of chalitza, which involves a shoe and spitting and declarations and all kinds of things. It functions as a kind of mini-divorce, and carries with it the consequences of what divorces carry in biblical and rabbinic law, which is, among other things, that woman, after having gone through that process, cannot marry a kohen, cannot marry a priest.
She's a widow. She couldn't marry him anyway.
No, a widow is allowed to marry a priest, just not the high priest, okay? Unless you're reading Sefer Yechezkel, but that's another story. Okay. That's the normal case. However, what's striking about this law? What is the normal relationship between brothers and brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law? It is a completely forbidden relationship. It's an erva. It's on one of the lists in the Torah. It's on the list in Vayikra, Yudchet, and Kaf as being among the surei erva, the kretot, the things that carry very serious penalties. That is to say, this same woman If for some reason that bond didn't exist, most normally because she actually had a child with the man who died, is completely off limits. Okay, so this is a very high voltage game. It is either a completely forbidden relationship or a relationship that has like positive valence to it and is so bonded that if you want to get out of it, you need some kind of ritual to break it. Okay, good. And just so we refresh ourselves, if one indeed was intimate with one's brother-in-law and had a child, what would the result be? That child would be a mamzer. Okay, if this was not a licensed levirate marriage, then as far as kinship rules are concerned, they would produce a child with a lineal taint that is indelible that would carry on through the generations. Okay, generally, though, we're pretty clear on whether this rule applies. However, sometimes there are weird cases, like where the dead husband was, while alive, married to two women. Okay? And normally, if he's married to two women, then all that happens is the surviving brother essentially chooses one of the women. There's algorithms how to do it. But basically chooses one of the women, fulfills or breaks the levirate bond with one of the sisters-in-law. But what if one of those women is his daughter? How could that happen? It is not forbidden, according to the Torah, to marry your niece. It is forbidden to marry your aunt. But it is not forbidden to marry your niece. In fact, marriage to a niece was considered a desirable match until quite recently in Jewish history. Any of you have ever heard of the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, great Rosh Yeshiva, commentator on the Torah, married his niece. Okay, this was a common thing to do. And therefore, someone who is married to their niece, who dies childless, that woman then falls before her father, right, as a potential levirate partner. Now, obviously, there is no bond between the father and his daughter. They are related, they are next of kin. She doesn't need to do anything, she doesn't need to do any chalitza. They're related. She just picks up, even if the dead man was childless, and moves on. But the question is, what about this case? Here, I'll just spin it so you see it for a second. All right, that's the completed chart. If you've got, you got it committed into memory. If you've got a man who was married to two women, one of whom was his niece, and the other was just a nochrit, a woman unrelated in any way to the family, then how do we think about the levirate bond between the surviving brother and this unrelated woman? And in short, there are two ways to think about that. One way to think about it is, well, this woman's his daughter, but who cares? This woman's not. The normal levirate rules apply, which means ideally they would get married, and if they don't want to, they have to break the bond. If she doesn't break the bond and goes off and marries someone else, that's an illegal kind of a marriage, which will result in disqualifying her own future status for a Kohen and disqualify her child's status for a Kohen as well. But this is the kind of marriage that is perfectly fine. But not a mamzer. The other, because they're not kin, right? However, another way to look at this is, this man shared an intimate space, shared a household with this woman and the man's daughter. And effectively, that makes them all kind of one family unit who are next of kin. That is to say, at the end of the day, there's just sort of one step removing this woman from the man's own daughter. And therefore, I look at that and I say, that is not a family unit that this surviving brother should be going anywhere near in terms of any kind of sexual intimacy. And therefore, it's obvious that just as the daughter is out, the other woman is out as well. I formulated in sort of logical terms to capture that value. If you can't engage in levirate marriage with all, right, any of a man's wives, you can't do it with any given one of them. Okay? So that is the debate of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And if you take that second position, note, once you say the bond does not exist, it reverts to being a forbidden brother-in-law, sister-in-law situation. Which means that we have now constructed a case, we'll see it now in the text in a second, where Beit Shammai are going to require or praise something which Beit Hillel will forbid and abhor. Beit Shammai will see the offspring of such a union as being the redemption of the line of the dead brother. Beit Hillel will see a mamzer, someone who is indelibly tainted. Someone who follows Beit Shammai's position and says, well, I have to break the bond here, okay? If that woman gets up and marries someone else without ever breaking the bond, she has done something problematic and it will affect her status. Whereas Beit Hillel will say, there was never a bond to break at all, she can simply go ahead and remarry. Let's see this now in the text. Mishnah and Tosefta Yevamot. Beit Shammai permit the co-wives to the brothers. This is the case of the tzarot, the tzarat habat, okay? Tzara just means the co-wife. Literally, it means basically the one who aggravates someone, okay? It comes from, anyone know? Right. Where in the Tanakh and the Torah? It comes a number of places. But the story of Pnina and Chana that we read on Rosh Hashanah, v'chiyasata tzarata gam kaas. So that description already is biblical, but here it's used as a technical term to mean the co-wife. This is the co-wife, the unrelated woman who is nonetheless sharing a marital space with the man's daughter. Okay? Beit Shammai say, that woman is fine. No problem. The brothers can marry her. And therefore, like, it's good. It would be a fulfillment of the biblical commandment of levirate marriage. Beit Hillel forbid. Therefore, as a consequence, if they perform chalitza, the ritual of formal release from the levirate bond, then Beit Shammai disqualifies such women from later marrying a kohen, because that's what happens with a chalitza. It's like a mini-divorce, and it has that consequence. Beit Hillel, however, say they can go ahead and marry a kohen. Why? They never needed to, nor should have done that chalitza in the first place. There was no bond to break. If a co-wife consummates the levirate marriage, then Beit Shammai validate her to marry a kohen if the lever subsequently dies, meaning why not? It was a perfectly normal and valid marriage that she entered into. Whereas Beit Hillel would disqualify her from doing so because that's outrageous that she slept with her brother-in-law. The Tosefta Yevamot goes on and says, if a co-wife marries a man other than the lever without performing chalitza first, Beit Shammai says their child is disqualified from marrying a kohen. Beit Hillel says their child is valid to marry a kohen. If a co-wife consummates levirate marriage, Beit Shammai says their child is valid to marry other Jews. Beit Hillel says the child is a mamzer and invalid to marry other Jews. Okay, now, if you didn't follow all those details, you can promptly forget them all, more or less. You should hopefully have gotten the sense of the overall pattern here, which is we have dueling systems of interpreting what the Torah wants. Each one thinks it is a correct articulation of the law. It's not, fascinatingly, a question of leniency versus stringency. Actually, each side has their leniency and their stringency around this. And the consequences of this are not just that people will disagree, but because it involves genealogy, what is very quickly going to happen if this experiment continues to be run? Sorry? That's right. You're phrasing it as a question. I'll state it as a declaration. They will soon not be able to marry each other. Right? Very quickly, these systems will start to produce people who Beit Shammai just allow to blend into their population without any hesitation. And Beit Hillel will say, those are mamzerim, and they're starting to basically mess up all the gene lines in that community. And in the reverse way, Beit Shammai will look over at Beit Hillel and say, they're not keeping track of all of these women who are invalid to marry kohanim, to marry priests. We can't just freely intermarry with them. All right? This, in a schematic way, there's all kinds of ways we can distinguish between the two cases, but in a schematic way, is extremely parallel to issues we grapple with today around disputes over valid conversions, and disputes over lineality, matrilineal and patrilineal, in defining Jewish identity. You have different ways of understanding, different understandings of what the Torah wants, Judaism wants, the time demands, etc., and mutually exclusive ways of making them, right? It becoming very quickly incompatible in a way that actually defines the whole population. All right, that's the dilemma that we've got here. Any questions or clarifications on this before now we go in to see, so how did rabbinic sources try to deal with this? Yeah. Right. So there are, you know, the Mishnah likes to point out in Tractate Eduyot and other places, the Kulei Beit Shammai, the things that are sort of unusual in that way. Here, I do want to emphasize, though, yes, with respect to the Mamzer designation, they are more lenient because they can never get a Mamzer sort of playing out here. But with respect to who is invalidated with respect to a Kohen, they are the ones who are more stringent. So it's less about trying to think in a lenient or stringent frame, and it is more about applying the rules differently, and then it turns out that the rules of kinship and the kihuna, etc., break this way and that way and that way and the other. I understand. Though, let's also, yes, so you're also still only thinking about it through the lens of what's going to be hard or a burden for the offspring. From the perspective of Beit Shammai, I have no doubt that they thought that they were being quite strict on the law of levirate marriage, which is to say, to the extent that there is some obligation to the dead brother to either redeem his line or to honor it by breaking the bond, Beit Shammai were probably horrified by the way in which they felt Beit Hillel cavalierly waved that away in this situation. So that doesn't necessarily leave a taint on the next generation. That's true, but it is nonetheless a stringency that goes the other way. Okay, good. Let's now go on and see what these sources do. So turn to the next page. This is an interesting passage from the Tosefta. I've presented it here in order as it appears, more or less, a couple of brief excerpts. Brief ellipses that cut out some pieces, but more or less the uninterrupted text. But this is a text you have to be careful about. It is not a text that you can read as one coherent piece, because what it actually is a collection of conflicting memories and strategies for dealing with this problem. So let's start with paragraph 1, which stands on its own. I want to understand what's being said here, and then we're going to go back to our initial triangle and see where we can locate this initial position. So can I have a volunteer to read us from Sid Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri? Please. Thank you. All right, let's start with Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Okay, what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri propose? What is the facts we have here, that you're welcome to restate that, but what is the nature of his proposal? How does he propose solving this problem? Yeah.
Great, be double strict, but play it out. How does it work here?
Good. So we are going to treat this like a real bond in the spirit of Beit Shammai, in the sense that we will require you to sever it, and we will treat that woman then as forbidden to a Kohen, et cetera, all the consequences. And we will treat it as a problematic next of kin relationship, like Beit Hillel, in never allowing them to actually consummate the relationship. Okay? Now, where does this sit on our triangle?
It sits on the bottom leg. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, we cannot have
ongoing pluralism and keep the Jewish people together here. It is not going to work to have Beit Shammai do their system, Beit Hillel do their system, and they're each producing their things. What we got to do is actually quash that. We are going to start over. We are going to have a new standard. We are, interestingly enough, going to build that standard out of the ashes of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel's position by picking the two strict elements of them. But from now on, right, going forward, bo v'natkin, what's going to happen now is in those cases, we will have one standard which everyone will follow consistently, and then everyone will be able to marry one another and understand the issues at work. All right? This is a classic anti-pluralistic solution. Anti-pluralistic solutions are often great. They are often compelling. They often get lots of adherence. They are particularly compelling to people who want to say, your position, what is so holy about your position? It's the only right way to think about this, right? Like, let's find a way where basically we can all sort of put some of our decisions, our differences aside, come together around one thing. The most important thing is that we have a clear, predictable, consistently enforced regime of law and practice, and that Am Yisrael, in this case, remains one. That's what's important. Everything else is, if not nonsense, too risky for getting in the way of this. That's Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. These kinds of compromises are raised all the time, right? Some of you may remember from years ago, this sort of anti-pluralistic compromise was the proposal of the Ne'eman Commission around dealing with conversion in Israel. How do we deal with the different denominational streams? No one can agree, participating, not participating, legitimating, not legitimating. Here's what we're going to do. The Ne'eman Commission came out and said, all of the rabbis of all of the streams are going to be involved in the conversion process, the education process of the convert. And then when we get to the point of the immersion in the mikveh, there will be three male Orthodox rabbis who will supervise it. And the idea was, we're not going to have a situation where this one's doing this kind of conversion, that one's doing that kind of conversion, this accepts it, this resents it. Everyone's going to have to agree that basically everyone is involved in the process in some way. And we're going to tinker who has what role in a way that we think will basically enable everyone to get on board. Now, the Ne'eman Commission failed. Why? Why did it fail? What is problematic, even as I just talked about what's positive, what is problematic about anti-pluralistic solutions, or why do they sometimes not work? Yeah. Okay, so one thing might be that you end up being super strict, though I think, interestingly, right, the Ne'eman Commission, I think, was probably perceived as not being sufficiently strict in both directions. That is to say, non-Orthodox rabbis felt like, you're actually not taking us seriously, which was the whole reason we came to the table, because at the clear moment of transition of identity, you're kicking us out of the room. And the Orthodox rabbi said, you're not taking us seriously. We think those people are heretics. How can you involve them in the education process of the convert just because technically we're the ones in the room at the end? So there is, but I want to pick up on the second thing you said, because I think sometimes it may play out as it's excessively strict, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri may be a good case of that. Right, no, which is great. But the what the strictness, I think, captures even more is the notion of each side essentially having its understanding of what is right here taken away from it. Right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri is trying to meet that halfway. You'll get half of this. But imagine for a minute how Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel might have reacted to this proposal. Beit Shammai would say, you're forbidding Yibum? Like, the whole reason that I think the levirate marriage should be, the bond is there, is you're supposed to be able at least to redeem a dead brother's life. What kind of compromise is this? You're basically kicking me out of the picture. And Beit Hillel, I think, could come along and say, you're going to make me do chalitza, this release of some kind of stringency? You are breaking down the very kinship taboo that is the reason I don't want anyone even thinking that this family is someone, that these women are, you know, some, are figures that this man can go near, all right? So I think it's broad, it's sort of broadening. I think the stringency piece is very much what happens often as one example of what have we done to the initial positions. All right, so that's one thing. That is to say, the reason pluralism exists in the first place is usually because people feel pretty strongly about their individual position. Okay, good. What else? What else might be not compelling about this solution of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri? We seem to get a hint of it. What's that? Yeah, please.
It doesn't seem to be very consistent with the way our tradition has been functioning for a while.
Meaning?
Meaning that there's often a variety of opinions. You know, we're kind of going through this always, and then suddenly now we...
Good. So another thing about anti-pluralistic situations, particularly in rabbinic Judaism, is they can feel like maybe they cut against the grain of the entire discussion. They go, they're sort of not in the DNA. It's like what rabbis trying to act like clear-cut legislators is often a kind of a cultural problem. And that may be part of the issue here of like these people are not actually set up for hammering out the sort of practical legislative compromise, and it's just difficult to play that out. Great. Another piece I think we see also hinted at here with Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is these kinds of anti-pluralistic proposals, resolutions, I think tend to only be as compelling as they are comprehensive. That is to say, to the extent that you will completely solve the problem, maybe I'll look at it. To the extent I'm still going to have a headache with unresolved things and you've made me kind of pull back on my position, that's much less compelling, right? Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel here says, there are already generations of people who acted based on Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. That's great. You've come up with a solution and we won't compound the problem further going forward. But I'm stuck with people that I can't marry according to the opposite view. So, im kvar az kvar, if there's going to be, you know, a mess left on the table, then why should I forfeit my understanding of what the Torah's proper rule is, right? This you have seen all the time over the years in Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, right? Like the Israelis always want, at the end of the day, after all the concessions and everything is agreed, an end of conflict statement. If I'm going to give up X, Y, and Z thing, I want to know that it's over. Because otherwise, what have I done going down this road if then it's just going to be relitigated? That, I think, is some of the piece here. It's hard to know all of what lies behind. Things fell apart before they could seal the deal. It could be a historical piece there. There could be any number of other pieces. But something about this doesn't hold together. Yeah. Yes, it doesn't mean integrity here. I mean that from now forward, this is the law of the land and that is what you do. That doesn't mean no one grumbles about it. That doesn't mean that no one still harbors a wish that it would be different. But it means that you are from now forward consistent. No one is sort of breaking what the rule is. That's part of the bo natkin. They come together, they agree. Here's how we're going to do it. Right, so it would be like, I'll give you another example. A community that was deadlocked around how to deal with gender equality in tefillah, in prayer. And they were based, and there was a whole faction that was like, we really think there should be no gender restrictions. And there was another group that was like, we really think the traditional and right way to do it is men should lead the davening. And they decided that they were going to come to a rule where only women were going to lead Kabbalat Shabbat, and only men were going to lead Arvit. And that was because they had cobbled together a theory that, well, in Kabbalat Shabbat, even the people who are opposed can think of it as a not fully obligatory service. And the people who prefer that there's gender blindness will, at the end of the day, experience one man and one woman leading everything every week. Now, somewhere deep in the sort of consciousness or maybe in the longing, there may be people that want to roll back, turn over, etc. But at the end of the day, if they sign on to that, or there's some police power that really meaningfully enforces it, that will be the consistent rule week in, week out, and no one will have to sort of confront aberrations to that from other views. Let me give you another example of this, just to clarify, not even from the religious law, where anti-pluralistic solutions often are like the end result of a long, protracted process. The legal history of same-sex marriage in the United States exactly also followed this triangle. You had, once certain states started to legalize it, a pluralistic kind of federalist regime, different states doing different things. And then the question was, how are we going to deal with the other two vertices? So some states, like Missouri, said, same-sex marriage is illegal here. But we are in community with the other states in the union. Therefore, if someone comes in with a marriage license from Massachusetts, we will register them, even though it is completely inconsistent. If those two people had showed up to a clerk here and tried to get married, they would be rejected. And also, now there'll be people from Missouri who will go away for the weekend and come back married. It's not maximizing integrity in the sense, again, I'm not using that good or bad. I'm using it in the sense of not maximizing integrity in terms of consistency of the law, but it's saying, we're committed to, Missouri should be able to do it one way, Massachusetts should be able to do it one way, if that's the way it's come out, and we're in community with one another, this full faith and credit. Other states said, no. What it means for us to forbid same-sex marriage is, if two people of the same gender show up, they ipso facto can't be married. I don't care what kind of piece of paper you show up with. And the result is, yeah, we're not having full community and full faith and credit around marriage with the other states in the union. That played out for many years until the Supreme Court came in with the Obergefell decision and cut this down and said, that is the end of pluralism. There's going to be one law in the United States which will be consistent and which will be across the board. Now, I give you that because, of course, there are individuals, there are clerks, there are legislators that may be very unhappy about that. There might be people who engage in civil disobedience. But as far as the law is clear. All right? And that's the sense in which I'm using it. It doesn't mean everyone is like in the depths of their soul, totally. You'll see in the next passage here in just a second, what does it look like to say, we're going to have different standards, and the way we're going to work it out is on the backs of integrity. And you'll see it looks very different from Rabbi Yochanan ben Yehuda. All right, so thank you for that question. It's important to clarify and sharpen. Yeah. That's correct.
But if you come here with a marriage certificate,
that's right.
From the United States or Cyprus or whatever, we will we'll honor it.
Yes.
So it's exactly the same thing. That they're it's exactly your example. That's what's done here.
That's correct. Meaning there's a pluralism. Israel has its marriage laws. Other countries has their marriage laws. They're signatories to treaties. That means they have to recognize it. And that means there's going to be inconsistency.
But that doesn't mean that everybody's happy.
No, that's right. I'm not saying it's happy. Now, we're not claiming every solution is happy. But nonetheless, you can have a solution. You can have something that you understand. That's how it works right now. By the way, I think there are some people who are happy with it. Right? So that's always going to be a question. Okay, let's go to the second paragraph now. Can I have a volunteer for a totally different picture of how this plays out? Oh, wait. No, that's right. That's good. Rabban Shimon Montgomery, we took care of. Good. Second paragraph. Yes.
Even though Beit Shammai disagreed with Beit Hillel about the co-wives, Beit Shammai did not refrain from marrying women from Beit Hillel, nor Beit Hillel from Beit Shammai. Rather, they practice truth and peace with each other. As it says, love, truth, and peace.
From Zechariah, related to what we talked about earlier. Okay, go ahead.
Rav Shimon says, they did not refrain from cases where there was only a possible problem, but they did refrain from cases where the problem was certain.
Okay. Let's understand what's happening here, and this is a case where you need to properly understand Rabbi Shimon in order to understand the position he responds to. So what do we have here? This is detached from what came before. Okay? They disagree, as we laid out. But nonetheless, they married each other. Okay? What does that mean? That means this, what I'm going to call Tosefta 2. That means something like the following. And then I'll prove to you that that's what it means from Rabbi Shimon. That means something like the following. Just like the case of Missouri, Beit Hillel sees someone that according to their rules is a mamzer, because they're a descendant of one of these co-wives. But they know that this person comes from Beit Shammai, and that a Beit Shammai community, authority, court, rabbi, however we construct it, authorized that. And this person, therefore, was acting within their sort of own internal frame of reference of doing what was the right thing. And therefore, the full faith and credit, here translated as Ha'emet v'ashalom e'avu, means that even though if this situation had come to pass in their own community, Beit Hillel would have said, that person's a mamzer, they can't marry anyone else here. When it comes from Beit Shammai's world, they will nonetheless marry that person. Okay? Now, and how does the drasha, how does the idea work here? Ha'emet v'ashalom ehavu, love, truth, and peace. Okay? I think the reading here is, yes, love, truth, that's important. Integrity is important, but it's truth and peace. If your adherence to 100% perfect maximized integrity is going to result, let's keep it local, and we can argue how much it generalized, is going to result in tearing the Jewish people into two groups that cannot marry each other, then, at least in this case, there is a value of peace, of community, of Am Yisrael, which affirmatively pushes you to be inconsistent, obviously against the backdrop, and this is a thorny thing we'll come back to, against the backdrop of Beit Hillel relating to Beit Shammai, perhaps as wrong, but not necessarily as sort of illegitimate and unrecognizable, right? And just as Missouri doesn't treat Massachusetts the same as just some person who decides to write up a marriage certificate, Beit Hillel would say, Beit Shammai, with their interpretation of Torah, their way of thinking it through, is already a force to reckon with. Ha'emet v'hashalom ehavu. Now, how do you know that's the reading? And then I want to just give a little further oomph for like really understanding why someone would say that. Rabbi Shimon is horrified by this, which indicates that that is clearly how he understood it. He disagrees and he says, No. What do you mean they didn't refrain from marrying each other? Mina safek lo hayu nimna'in. They perhaps had no restraints around marrying people in the other group about whom there was some doubt. It was uncertain. I heard something is maybe not right in the family tree there. Aval nimna'in and mina vadai. What are you, crazy? Of course, when it was a case where they looked and said, that person's a mamzer according to my calculation, no way would they have allowed a marriage in that case. That is to say, Rabbi Shimon, right, is probably located somewhere over here, which is to say, I'll take maybe a little hit on the integrity. Here you go again. Okay? I'll take a little hit on the integrity, but I can't actually let you trample all over that value. Now, I just want to make sense of this because I think people have a very hard time sometimes imagining that, like, this initial view in the Tosefta, which Rabbi Shimon is disagreeing with, like, how could a halachic text or rabbinic authority think that way? And here, I think we just don't fully appreciate the possibility of sitting on that side of the triangle, because we tend to think of the dynamic of community mistakenly as entirely being about compromise in order to enable people to get along. And that is not what it is here. Ha'emet va'shalom ehavu here is invoked to say there is a positive value to Klal Yisrael having some kind of ability to basically blur lines, blur their boundaries one into another. Because if you take seriously, this is me explicating it here, but I think this is what lies behind it. If you take seriously the fact that the Torah was not revealed to just a series of 600,000 individuals, and it wasn't revealed even to like and Beit Hillel and Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, but it was revealed to the entire Am, which by the way is not like a self-evident revelation story at all, right? You can easily imagine a very coherent revelation story of one person gets something and then passes it on to everyone else, right? The Torah is quite clear that as much as Moshe may get, it's not sort of fundamentally about him getting the Torah. It's actually about everyone, certainly the way Chazal, our sages, understood it. And if that's the case, then there is some actual like ontological and legal meaning to Am Yisrael, such that when, again, with the caveat of sort of viewing someone as wrong but not illegitimate, when some other Beit Din or group of people actually determines something to be valid, like that does something to other people who are committed. Remember, go back to my definition. You are vulnerable to and dependent on other people's decisions and practices. For those who study halacha in depth and are sort of open to seeing this, you actually see it in all kinds of places. Every time people say, Yesh al mili smoch, there's someone to rely on here. Or in a pressing circumstance, you can follow this view that we don't normally follow. That is all this sort of language, which is saying, look, I think that's wrong. But once it's sort of out there in some way, it affects the system in some degree. And we argue what degree, to what extent, in what case, etc. But the notion of that is what seems to be powering this view. And again, appreciating Rabbi Shimon's dissent from it should teach us two things. One, to understand what he is dissenting from, which is something enough to aggravate him, right? And two, that it was complicated, right? That we can see Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri was not a slam dunk, but nor was this second paragraph in the Tosefta. But nonetheless, it's there. It's another strategy for dealing with this problem. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there were three big rabbis that spoke and gave their position. One was some big reform rabbi that I don't know who it was. The second one was the rabbi down the street. No, the older rabbi.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have 2 or 3 or 10 Jewish peoples instead of one Jewish people. So where would you put...
Yeah, here's where I put it. And this is very important. I want to explain this diagnostically for understanding the case you just said, but I'm not particularly taking a side on it. Rabbi Riskin's statement in that context only makes sense if you take for granted that it is completely impossible for him to compromise on his integrity. Okay, now, that might be right. That might be justified, because ultimately, I think,
probably, what Rabbi Riskin would say, I don't want to speak for him, is he would probably say, I consider those views not just to be wrong, but to be completely aberrant and illegitimate views that I can't even actually include in my system, okay? But bracket that for a minute. Whatever the reason and motivation, it's because he is not willing to treat it as, look, that is wrong, I don't think so, but what am I going to do? Sometimes you have to be inconsistent in the name of Am Yisrael. And that's exactly what I hope this sort of triangle and framework will help you sharpen, is to realize a lot of times people say, oh, I can't compromise. What they actually mean is I can't compromise because I'm taking for granted one of these values as immovable. And truth be told, they're all movable all the time. In theory, the question is, why do we sometimes engage some of them and why do we sometimes not? There's no question one of the things motivating us to stay away from the community side of things is if we can't really swallow the sort of legitimate pluralism of the different views, and or we feel that what's at stake with deviating from my integrity is so overwhelming, right, then you're in another place. Obviously, issues of Jewish status, of whether you are a Jew at all, are particularly vexing, because if you don't think that someone meets your definition of a Jew, then it's not even clear whether there's an imperative by the Klal Yisrael theology I laid out to be in community with them. That's where those issues get particular. It's one thing, okay, I disagree on, is this person a mamzer, is there not? But I still sort of on some level like, but we're in the same group, right? If you actually disagree around the group identity, you're starting to have an argument over whether some, right, there's some of the debates right now about immigration in the United States, right? Is there an obligation of fairness to someone who lives in Syria? Right? Like I can't even agree over sort of who is within my group. It's very easy for Americans to get behind, well, you can't discriminate based on religion for people who are citizens. But then you start taking it beyond the borders, you're actually kind of having a discussion and an argument over who are we responsible to. Okay, let's move on now to the third paragraph. This is an interesting paragraph which actually combines two things. It starts off with another anti-pluralistic strategy. Le'olam halacha kedivrei Beit Hillel. This is more like the Obergefell example that I gave. Another way you do it, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Yuri tries to make a nice compromise that maybe everyone will kind of agree on, but another way is you just shut down Beit Shammai. This is a perfect example where I presume Beit Shammai are not going to be thrilled at the moment of being shutting down that they lose. But for the community, it's a way of saying, sorry, you lost. That's not the halakha anymore. We've shut down that pluralism. And now everyone follows Beit Hillel consistently, and Shalom al Yisrael, everyone's happy. Okay. The rest of the paragraph, however, deviates from that and lays out a different piece, which ultimately is on this line, which I'm just going to call Tosefta 3. And it says as follows. Someone who wants to be strict to follow Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, to cherry-pick the stringencies of both of them. This sounds a little like Rabbi Yochanan Ben-Nuri, right? But not in the sense of a new takana, in the sense of each time I come along, I'm kind of haphazardly strict. The frumest common denominator strategy. Al ze ne'emar haksil b'choshech yelech. That person is a fool. Okay? Now, why are you a fool? Because you think you're like being all pious, but ultimately, there's like no coherence to what you're doing at all. You have neither the advantage of Beit Shammai nor of Beit Hillel. There's no animating understanding. Hatofes kulei Beit Shammai v'kulei Beit Hillel, if you grab onto the leniencies of both, you're a rasha. You're not a fool. Then you're just tendentiously, wickedly trying to get around the law. Because every time something's easier, you go for that. Rather, you can follow Beit Shammai or you can follow Beit Hillel, but you must do them with all of their stringencies and all of their leniencies. Meaning, integrity. Pluralism and integrity. Beit Shammai is fine. Beit Hillel is fine. This is where you see the first line here can't really fit with the rest of the paragraph, right? You can follow either one, but you got to do it with full consistency. And what is the unspoken result of that? You won't be able to marry the other people, at least freely. There's going to be meaningful restrictions because you're following different stuff. And that's what it looks like to value it, right? Go back to the Kotel example I cited earlier to say, I don't want to tell people how to daven.
I'm not interested in legislating that. I want the Jewish people to have a vibrant range of options. And I am not interested in getting people to have to compromise, certainly at this most sacred of spaces that's most important to them. There's going to be different sections. That's how we're going to do it. Okay? So this section of the Tosefta, I think, really maps out in an amazing way the sort of different and competing strategies for dealing with the triangle. All of them are making choices. Right? There is no way to let Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel continue to operate at full throttle, never be inconsistent, and freely intermarry with each other. You can't do it. Okay, let's move now to the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli, and this will round out our picture on page 3. Someone volunteer to take the Talmud Yerushalmi here, which is going to start with Tosefta 2. Please.
Even though Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed about the collabs, Beit Shammai did not refrain from marrying women from Beit Hillel, nor Beit Hillel from Beit Shammai. Rather, they practiced truth and peace, as it says, love, truth, and peace. Among theirs is at stake, and you say for the same.
Let's just pause there. So what's happened? We quoted Tosefta 2. We've quoted the piece that's pluralism community, And the Yerushalmi, here you can see, the Yerushalmi clearly understands this paragraph the way I explained it, right? Which is, what does it understand the paragraph to be authorizing? It authorizes people to do what? To marry someone they think is a mamzer. Which is why it provokes this scream, mamzerut beintayim v'ata marhachi? This mamzerut is on the line, and you are saying, go ahead and marry them? How could that be? Right? The Yerushalmi is screaming in the voice of which value? Integrity. Right? Like how? The Yerushalmi cannot imagine, at least at this stage, that we mean, no. Like most of the time you're a vegetarian. Right? That's what, right? For many years, by the way, that's like I was a vegetarian, except on Purim, that was one interesting thing. And like when I went to my grandparents' house. Okay, right? In other words, but the Yerushalmi can't imagine that you would do that. Okay. Go. It's going to develop it further. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Boon. Yeah, continue, please. Sorry.
Rabbi Yosef, then Rabbi Boon said, Rav and Shmuel disagreed. One said they both followed the halakha, i.e. and acted like Beit Hillel. One said these followed their halakha, and these followed their halakha. Mamzer is at stake, and you say such a thing.
Okay, so what do we have here now? Now we have an even somewhat of a crazier thing. Rabbi Yosef or Rabbi Boon quotes a debate. What's the debate between Rav and Shmuel? What does Rav say? How does he solve the problem? How did Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel not lead to the meltdown of the Jewish people? Halacha k'Beit Hillel, meaning, according to Rav, Beit Shammai never acted on their view. Yeah, Beit Shammai said this, Beit Hillel said this, but you will see. They both agreed that they were going to follow. What is this? What data does this completely ignore? Remember Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? What are we going to do about the earlier generations who already did this? So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel seems to be a historical testimony to the fact that they did it. Okay, but by the time of Rav, that doesn't appear in the Yerushalmi, it doesn't appear in the Talmud Bavli. May not have had that tradition. He already imagined, allows himself to reimagine this debate as being theoretical. But Shmuel, his colleague, comes in and says, no, that's a distortion. Eluki ilchatan. They each acted on their own thing. To which the Yerushalmi exclaims again, but what do you mean? Then Mamzerut would be at stake. And we know that they freely married each other. So the Yerushalmi so far is having a hard time. It is holding constant the fact that they really acted out these dueling positions, and they really married each other. Okay, so now we get the Deus ex machina, quite literally.
God watched over them in a case that would have produced a problem of Mamzeru never arose.
Hamakom mishamer velo eira ma'aseh me'olam. All right, now let's understand. It's like a cute text, but what's going on here? I mean, what do you understand? Just technically, what do you understand the answer is here? Like, what actually happened? They did follow their own rules, and how did God prevent it from being a problem? What does that mean? Yeah.
They're rewarded for maintaining community by that God supports them, keeping
them. Good. You're giving already the value statement, but I'm asking even just technically, how did this happen? Like, how?
They
How did they avoid that? I thought it's Lo Ying Yu. They didn't have a problem.
How they would never have any offspring, meaning it turned out, in every case, I erased my thing. In every case where that came up, there was never anyone who was actually born. In other words, it turned out. The problem is that's not the only problem, because there's also the problem of the women who are involved in those cases not being able to marry Kohanim. And it seems to be the part of the Lo Nimne'u is they didn't do like all kinds of back-checking on whether the other people met their standards of what was going on. Right? That seems to be the sort of basis of Lo Nimne'u. So even if we get rid of the offspring, it seems like there's some restrictions that should be in place. Yeah?
No man who married two women died childless.
All right, so you could say the whole thing never happened at all. The problem is that doesn't really fit with Shmuel's statement, Elu kihil chatan ve'elu kihil chatan. Now you can say this represents a rollback of that, right? It represents some degree of, we said Elu Kiyo Chatan and Elu Kiyo Chatan, but it just means they were theoretically prepared to follow through on it, but it never actually happened. Okay, that I would say is the most conservative reading of the Yerushalmi, right? It a little distorts, I think, the plain sense of Shmuel, but that is the most conservative reading. Great. Other readings, yeah. But then how do you understand Lo Irama Ase? It never happened. That sounds like a shopping jurisdiction. This seems like something. And remember, the shopping jurisdictions is already the thing that they seem to be bothered by, right? The Yerushalmi doesn't seem to like the notion that someone would be like, well, you think there are moms there, but I think they're not, so it's okay. And like, if according to your rules, this is the case, that should present like an integrity meltdown. Right? I don't think there's like an easy and obvious answer to this. I want you at least to entertain the more radical reading of this text, which let's say presumes that there's not like a call coming down from heaven every Friday afternoon to the matchmakers telling them not who to do it, is this is the story that is told. That is to say, I can't say I'm going to marry a mamzer. Like that, I can't do that. The Yerushalmi can't allow that kind of full frontal assault on integrity. But in practice, I can basically say some version of, we're not paying attention, and I'm assuming that there's no way that people who shouldn't be marrying each other are somehow getting matched up. That is to say, this would be the equivalent of saying, I don't know. I know those group of Jews have this kind of standard and that group of Jews have that kind of standard. There's no way my kid would end up falling in love with and marrying someone who had a problematic lineage on this front. And therefore, it must be either it turns out someone's matrilineal ancestor actually, went swimming with intention to become a Jew at some point in front of a group of people, or any number of other ways we might sort of talk this through. But I want us just to be aware of the possibility that this text is actually in practice living here over on the right side of the triangle, but is insisting on rhetoric that obscures that. That is to say, you can in practice potentially be living in a place where you are basically compromising your integrity. Meaning if someone ran some DNA check on all the people you married from the other group, they would turn up someone you think is a mamzer. But you do not look, you do not investigate, and you assume that somehow God is watching, not necessarily because deep down you really think it never happened, but because substantively you actually don't think integrity is the most important value in this context, but you do think it's supremely important not to talk in a way that sidelines integrity. Okay? If you want my opinion, that's what I think that Yerushalmi is saying. Though I acknowledge the more conservative reading is also possible. But you understand, in the reading that I'm suggesting, Shmuel really means what he says. They really did it. There were really people who were produced. But there was kind of a detente that was agreed to of, I am not going to look, and I'm assuming God is keeping the books on this.
But don't
If you really confronted me, okay? In other words, according to my reading, if you really confronted me, then either I would have a meltdown or I'd have to say, I don't believe you, right? Like, can't be. Can't be that person doesn't have maternal Jewish ancestry or whatever it is, right? But in this case, it would be, can't be. I don't believe you that person was really a tzarat about. There was something wrong with the original kiddushin. Or maybe there was a kid that was born at one point and, you know, and disappeared and no one heard from him again. Or something of that sort, okay? But essentially, something that constructs a public rhetoric of integrity, recognizing that you start to chip away at integrity and you start to lose the fundamentals of serious, consistent religious commitment, but in practice wants to be over on this right side of the triangle. Okay, thoughts or attacks on that, because I can see how you might not agree with that reading. But I'm trying to kind of preserve what I think is the plain sense of that Tosefta, and the fact that the Yerushalmi doesn't really ever seem to kill it off in fact, it just seems to start talking differently about it. Yeah?
A basic question, though. Within halakha, obviously, the concept of integrity to halakha is very important, and the concept of community calling Israel is very important. Are you trying to bring proof text to say that pluralism is an important halakhic principle, even when it means going against traditional perspectives of halakha?
Yes, in the sense that I'm using pluralism. In other words, not necessarily in the broadest sense of all the ways we use pluralism, but in the sense of, if we had more time and doing this in even greater depth, I'd bring you a passage from Rav Yitzchak Huttner, where he talks about Talmud Torah and sort of Eilu Va'eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, and basically saying, it's not the only value on the table, but there is a powerful value of actually wanting people to disagree to the extent that that represents, it's not that the disagreement itself is a value, but to the extent that the disagreement is a manifestation of a deep entry into the text, into the Torah, into, as it were, the mind of God, and saying, what does God want of me? And someone has come out with a genuine, committed answer to that, you strike that down at your religious peril. That, I think, is a value. It's not, isn't it so great everyone disagrees, right? It's that striking down disagreement is a kind of doing violence to, first of all, what might potentially be the right reading of the Torah, but second of all, actually in some deep way to a process of really allowing people and communities to go into the Torah. Once you're serious about it, and it's not just about them taking orders from above, almost of necessity produces some kind of multiplicity. Okay? Okay, let's look at the Talmud Bavli, which will be the last thing we'll look at, and this will make your head spin around the other way from the Talmud Yerushalmi. If the Talmud Yerushalmi, as I'm arguing to you, can be read, certainly can, if not should be read, as in a modified way embracing the right side of the triangle, just with the rhetoric of integrity, let's look at what the Talmud Bavli says. So someone want to take this? The last source, page 3. Please. Okay, so far that's parallel to the Yerushalmi, right? This debate, was it theoretical, was it actual? And now the Talmud Bavli is going to try to resolve this debate through proof texts. All right, go ahead.
Come and learn. Even though these forbid and those permit, Beit Shammai did not refrain from wearing women. Instead, they forbade Beit Hillel from Beit Shammai. Why not Beit Hillel from Beit Shammai? This test makes sense if you say Beit Shammai did not ask for their opinion, and therefore Beit Hillel did not
Okay, let's catch what happened here. The text here is trying to prove, initially, that Rav is right, that this was entirely a theoretical debate. And how does it do so? How does it prove that there's no way Beit Shammai could have actually followed through on their opinion? Lo nimne'u. We see that Beit Hillel did not refrain from marrying them. And what is the what assumption do you need to make in order for that to emerge as a proof text?
integrity is obviously inviolable for the Talmud Bavli. Well, I understand that this is a step way up from the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi was sort of shocked. How could they violate their integrity? And then seemed to say, well, maybe it's because God enabled it to work out and it was okay. The Talmud Bavli can so not comprehend the idea that you would be inconsistent about something like this, that the only way they can imagine that Beit Hillel would freely marry another group of women is if that group was not acting out any kind of policy that would create mamzerim for them. Okay, so it's not just sort of voicing integrity. Integrity is such a rock-bottom assumption that we cannot even fathom, at least at this point, that there would have been any practical manifestation of Beit Shammai. All right, so we really see that the Talmud Bavli in a major way is sitting at this vertex. Okay? It's willing to shut down the pluralism, right? It's willing to imagine that, like, well, maybe it was all theoretical. Like, they had some debate, but, like, they never really actually played it out. It's willing to maybe shut down the community piece and be like, you know, well, if they really were a mamzer, of course they wouldn't marry them. The thing that is not up for grabs is this vertex. All right? Now, nonetheless, continue on to the last piece here.
Now, Beit Shammai certainly acted on your opinion, but each group told one another which women were problematic according to the other's standards, and they distanced themselves from the
They had lists! That's what they did. They kept records and lists. So what does the Talmud say? It says, you know, come on. It ultimately can't really stomach Rav's view of it was all theoretical. They clearly did it, but this is still inviolable. There is no possible way that Beit Hillel married Mamzerim. So then what did they do? How did they twist? They didn't refrain from marrying? Ah, you're being even more generous. And then they didn't publish the list, and then they did it. I think it's even more stark than that. I think what it's saying is the list is there, and the list is the basis for them intermarrying. But in what sense do Beit Hillel not refrain from marrying Beit Shammai? They don't think they're lying about the list. That's how low it's got, right? You understand? Like, the thing that you might have thought is, if someone has this other interpretation of Torah, and it's totally wrong, and they think it's right, you might have thought I would say, well, I can't trust anything they say. Because look at them, they've got it all wrong. No, lo nimne'u. They agreed to rely on their list. This would be like, okay, right? It would be like if the CCAR, Central Conference of American Rabbis, kept a list of all patrilineally descended Jews, and once a year handed it over to the OU and said, okay, that, right? And everyone else not on that list, no problem, right? That there would be a sense of, look, I can't give your position some kind of legitimacy, but I don't think you're lying, and I will still marry you, assuming the facts bear out, okay? This, it should be very clear, okay? This is an extremely hobbled community, okay? It's still, I'm not saying there's nothing there, right? A lot of them can still marry each other. But it's not, this is like, going back to my food example, this is having a supervisor in the kitchen, all right? Now, it might even be the other person's supervisor, right? Like, it's not even, I am not trusting them, but it is basically saying, I'm not just going to eat anything you serve. If it comes out, it's not really so much, you know what the better example is? It's not the supervisor in the kitchen. It is inviting someone over with a nut allergy and putting signs in front of 3/5 of the dishes. Okay, that's what it is. You're accommodating that person. You are meaningfully having a relationship with them around some of the food. But at the end of the day, the atmosphere is not just, I go in there and I'm served a meal. There's not a full blurring of boundaries. If anything, there's a reifying of that boundary of actually, right, there's actually something like simultaneously considerate and aggressive going on in that moment, which is you have a nut allergy. God forbid, I don't want to do anything that's upsetting to you. And no way in hell am I purging my entire meal of nuts. Right? Okay? If you were going anti-pluralistic, you would say, right, I have friends who are nut allergic. I'm never going to have that in my house. Or if you were going anti-integrity, you'd be like, usually I serve things with nuts. When that person comes over, I don't. Right? When you put up signs, it's saying, you are who you are, I respect it. I am who I am, you better respect it. Okay? And that is what, and that's a barrier. Okay? This, I think, is very striking as being different from the Talmud Yerushalmi in that actually the Talmud Bavli, on some level, is willing to give up on some degree of the community because the integrity is so strong. And interestingly enough, it is not, at the end of the day, totally willing to throw the pluralism piece under the bus. It likes the idea that, no, I think Beit Shammai probably were able to act out their thing, but they must have understood that doing that, because this is inviolable, comes at the cost of some degree of community. Okay. Let me close us out here. One of the interesting things we could do as an exercise right now would be I would ask you to all stand up, and I would say, like, this point here is pluralism, and that corner is integrity, and that corner is community, and ask you to go stand somewhere and think about, and I do want you to think, not do that now, but I want you to think about, if I asked you, even though, as I said, different issues inspire different things, and this is really a model not meant to be completely consistent, but in my experience, people do often have tendencies and default places on this triangle when they think about the Jewish world and practice, etc. I will go so far as to say that in broad strokes, I think there are many people above the age of 50 who cluster very strongly towards the communal end of the triangle and a sense that Klal Yisrael is sort of a clear affirmative value and sometimes lose patience for everyone with their holy opinion and their inviolable inconsistency. And there are many people, many of whom I love and teach, who are under the age of 25 or under the age of 30, for whom the left side of the triangle represents the Kodesh HaKodeshim. God forbid anyone should tell me what to do, or I should tell them what to do, and God forbid anyone should be made to be forced to compromise not on their own terms. And if that means, great, we'll have five different parallel minyanim, and great, there'll be three different tables at this potluck, and all of the sort of splittings that happen, then that's the way we'll go. Now, as I said at the beginning, I don't think one of these is better or worse than the other. They are different, because probably all of us would agree that all other things being equal, if you asked us about any given of these three values, we'd be like, sure, give me some more of that. That sounds great. But when push comes to shove and you have to choose, I do think we ultimately get to slightly different places. I'll share with you, just in closing, my own sort of journey and orientation around this based on a lot of what we've seen is something like this. I drew an arrow in the starting in the bottom left vertex and heading to the right side, which is to say, what I take from the Talmud Bavli and also from the Talmud Yerushalmi is that ultimately, I think things have to sort of start and be anchored in a language and kind of perspective of integrity when we talk about religious obligation and sort of consistency and serving God and all the things that are larger than ourselves. But I basically invest all of my energy when I think and teach about halakha in getting to the right side of the triangle, which is to say the ultimate place where I want to live is in a place where I can be in a community where I am blurring boundaries as much as possible with people potentially disagreeing in genuine ways about what the right way is to understand the Torah, to practice Jewishly, etc., while still retaining the integrity. Now, I said to you, you can't do it all, right? And I still maintain that you can't do it all, which is why the only way I am able to do that ultimately is, one, to affirm that this is a value. You heard me talk about that. The value of community is not just about compromise, but there's some sort of value there. But also, and for those who have studied with me, you know, like, trying to expand the conversation of what can possibly be held within our discourse of halakha, even if it's things I disagree with. Like, I might even be like, I think that's wrong. But I can understand
how you might have come to that. Or here's how you would construct the argument that would still anchor you with sort of authenticity and intensity in the text to get there, such that then, to the extent I occasionally experience some inconsistency around it, I feel like what I am doing is latching onto a view that I can have some actual shared discourse and dialogue with. But it is not about short-circuiting it and getting all three at the same time. It is really, figuring out where are you anchored, where are your aspirations, and what are some of your tools for filling out that picture. So I will leave that there. I will say that, indeed, the copies of my new book are on sale. I think I have 7 5-shekel coins for the 75-shekel price, if you want to give me 80 shekels. Other than that, we'll have to scramble and figure it out. Obviously, if you're buying 2 copies, then 150 is a nice divisible by Bill's number. But I want to thank you again for coming and being part of this and sharing this issue.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.